Now from Washington, the Inside Scoop, all the news the government does not want you to know. Here's your host, Congressional Attorney Mark Levine.
But he goes through a number of things in his book, and It's really a book written for evangelicals, I think, and trying to come up with some core principles. And yet, the main complaints that people have about evangelicals, about the religious right, well, they're still there. Are they serving the poor? Certainly in the Bible, you see a lot of talk in the New Testament about how Jesus cares about the poor. You find in the Old Testament God caring about the poor. Does the religious right adequately care for the poor? What do they feel about the war in Iraq, for example? This book says virtually nothing about the war in Iraq. All it seems to say is that there are just wars and unjust wars, but doesn't address the great issue of the day. So I'm going to ask Bishop Jackson a number of very tough questions and dialogue with him. And if you want to join in the discussion, it's easy to do. The number is 202-588-0893. 202-588-0893, or you can obviously call in toll-free on my toll-free line, which is 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. Before I bring Bishop Jackson on, though, I want to go over a number of things that he says in the book, just to give you an idea of where he's coming from. He argues on a number of things that there can be reconciliation, I guess, between the left and the right, for example, on the issue of the environment. And I agree with him there. I mean, he talks about global warming. He recognizes that global warming is a problem, kind of. But then, going along, I guess, with his co-author, Tony Perkins, he goes on and on about the scientific studies that dispute global warming. Now, anyone who studied the science knows that you may have 1,000 studies talking about the real problem of global warming, and then one or two on the other side. And like most on the right, he seems to be conflating those two. I say, just sort of look at the science of the matter. And then he gets in talking about marriage. Now, here's something I've always felt that conservatives and liberals could agree with, that we should do things to strengthen marriage. One of the reasons why I like the recent California decision allowing gay couples to get married as well as straight couples is because it strengthens the institution of marriage. It allows couples of all kinds to be treated equally under the law. Obviously, the religious right is opposed to those kinds of marriage policies. A number of other things in the book, he does talk about racial reconciliation, but one of my concerns is that racial reconciliation requires real understanding of the horrors of our history. And it seems to me that while Bishop Jackson certainly shares that, he certainly had that upbringing growing up, a poor kid, poor African-American child in the South. In terms of actually fixing the damage, I don't see much there. I don't see much complaint about, for example, Bob Jones University, a university, religious right university, that until just recently would ban interracial dating. He spent a lot of time talking about abortion. He says that life begins at conception. And this, of course, is a common religious right concept, that life begins at conception. One of the things the religious right will never tell you, though, is that this is a very new conception for Christians. Until 1869, it was the position of the Catholic Church and most Protestant sects, and indeed under Jewish law as well, that life began at quickening. What is quickening? It's when the fetus is old enough to kick. And you can argue that that makes sense in some sort of living sense, that when it's a bunch of cells and it has no thoughts and it has no movement, then it's not alive in the sense that it can do anything and therefore can't think or feel. But when it's old enough to kick, well, then maybe it's thoughtful enough to take some action. Maybe then it is alive. In 1869, the Catholic Church, thinking that, well, they needed more Catholics, decided to change its policy and say that life begins at conception. Bishop Jackson's book doesn't explain this change, doesn't go into it, just sort of assumes that the Bible says that life begins at conception. I'm going to ask him about that. But that there are ways that the left and the right can come together. And one of them is, in fact, on trying to reduce the number of abortions. And that's something that I hope to discuss with him. So let's take a quick break. I'll let you call in if you want to. We'll go out and bring Bishop Jackson in. And then we'll be right back with more right after this. Welcome back. Sitting in front of me now is Archbishop Jackson, he was a little bit late, but, you know, that just illustrates the difficulty, perhaps, of this kind of dialogue. But here you're here. I'm glad you're here, and I want to welcome you.
Well, thank you so much. Really, it illustrates the fact that conservatives sometimes make a wrong turn.
Well, you know, I'll agree with you on that. There's no question I'll agree with you on that, Bishop. Now, since we last met a few weeks ago, I want you to know I have read your book, and I have many, many comments. In fact, I don't know that we'll get to them all throughout the hour. But let me start with, I guess, a basic tone in the book that I find that you seem to have and Tony Perkins seems to have, and I think a lot of the religious right does, and that is one of, I don't know a better word, but persecution. It seems that the tone that I see in the book, and correct me if you think I'm wrong, is that you feel like the religious right is under attack. Do you think so?
I think so, to a certain extent. What this is a manifestation of, Mark, is a feeling that I'm sure your listeners have, of polarization, that those on the right have become maybe a little bit too extremely right, and those on the left are a little bit extreme, and that creates this atmosphere or attitude that, hey, we got to watch out, we're under attack. So I believe you picked up on that correctly, that very often we feel that the media is not on our side, for example, and that folks really aren't hearing us out there stereotyping us. And you made a statement, I believe, in our last discussion, that it seems like left has become a bad word or something to that effect. And so I think what we've allowed to happen to ourselves is that the common ground that we could even dialogue about is not explored, and that we both are at these places where people are taking little rifle shots at us from extreme positions.
Well, here's the thing I think that surprised me, Bishop, is that when we did talk at that panel in the church, I think something that surprised both of us was how much agreement you and I had on a number of core things. We disagreed on specifics, but we agreed on a lot of general principles. And I took out your book, and I was hoping to see, I guess, more of that in your book. And there's some. I mean, I think you on the environment, on poverty, a lot of the general issues that we have to care about the environment, that we have to care about the poor, those were all there. Mm-hmm. But then they come to specifics, and we're as wildly apart as ever. And, you know, I just, when I read, for example, your section on health care, and I read about your truly inspiring story about how you survived esophageal cancer, and you talk about all the difficulties that are very familiar to liberals, to anyone in the audience. You talk about the fact that it costs $100,000, that you're a counselor on the phone with your insurance company, that you know, they wouldn't want to give you treatment for a new study that turned out to save your life. Yeah. And liberals look at that story, and as I read your story, I thought, great, now I'm going to turn the page, and he's going to come out, and he's going to support universal health care because he recognizes that there's all these awful problems in the system. And lo and behold, I turn the page, and it's not there. You disappointed me, Bishop.
Well, I believe in universal health care, but a different way of getting there. And the whole idea is, if you let people make their own choices, we're going to have to make monies available for folks at the lowest end of things, meaning there's got to be some way to put money in the hand of people who are not able to make the rent at the, you know, we still...
I couldn't agree with you more, but then in your book, your policy seems to be right out of Grover Norquist. You talk about tax rebates for people who can't even afford to pay taxes. I mean, come on, Bishop. You can't give tax rebates to someone who's dirt poor and can't afford health care.
Well, I agree with you on that. I think that we're saying, for the most part, that the majority of how this nation has worked, or the best way, is that we don't have government control, government stuff. During my treatments at Hopkins, we found that people were flying over from places like England and all over the world to get our health care. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist, I think you agree with me in the statement, to know that American government manages stuff very poorly.
I disagree. I think that if you design a government and you fill it with people who hate government and people who believe that government is not the answer, in other words, if you fill it with conservatives, then yes, you get bad government. If you get a government that says we shouldn't help people who are being hit by a hurricane, Hurricane Katrina comes, and they don't help people. But if you get a government like Bill Clinton's government, for whatever you think about his personal life, when we had disasters, he had James A. Witt, an expert, 30 years in federal emergency management. He took care of people when they were hit by hurricanes. I think government doesn't work when you supply it with people who don't believe in government.
Well, that's an interesting premise. I would agree with you on that, but I want to push back on you on this.
Go right ahead.
My pushback is that I've met reflection on conservatism. I think it was a reflection on leadership from the top, starting with Bush. It was a reflection on cronyistic picking of people who are in position. And we're going to have Obama or Clinton, probably Obama, if they get elected.
It looks like, by the way, just so you know, AP has announced Obama has clinched the nomination, so it looks like it will be Obama. I'll just give that out to our listeners who may not have heard the news. So go ahead.
Well, yeah. And I'm sure those particular Obama, whoever gets in, let's say it's not a conservative, is going to have to then make sure he's got the right people around him. So I don't think this ideological issue of conservative versus liberal is the cause of it. And then I would go a step further and say it may be the fact that we are seeing things so ideologically instead of practically that is part of the problem, is one of your points, I think, meaning that I don't want a conservative handling crisis in America if he's not competent. Give me a competent liberal versus an incompetent conservative any day.
I guess here's my problem. The conservative, look, obviously I'm not going to disagree that Mike Brown was a crony. I mean, he knew more about Arabian horses than he knew about emergency management. That's easy.
Right.
But I would suggest to you that part of it is philosophical, that conservatives believe that government shouldn't be helping people, that that's just not the role of government. And so when you have people in trouble in this nation, whether it be from a hurricane or from poverty or from a cruel criminal justice system or, child abuse, whatever it is, you right. don't see people looking for government solutions. And that, to me, I think, is a conservative value. Do you disagree?
No, I would agree with you on that. The issue, once again, is polarization. Let me unpack this in my thinking. On the left, I find, and before I came into ministry and all this, I was much more liberal-leaning, there's a tendency to want to have government do a lot. And I think the problem with conservative movement, it's supposed to be a revolutionary kind of reform of government, was how they started, to say less government. The problem is that when you start a reactionary reform movement and you've never let anything yourself, suddenly when you get all these years of conservatives in power, they realize that, hey, wait a minute, some government has to do the work. And in the era of poverty, you talked about that chapter, you'll notice that we had a role for government, a role for business, a role for the church, a role for individuals. And many liberal-leaning people tend to want to make the government do everything. And it may be a stereotype. That's how Tony and I looked at it. And we're saying, wait a minute, there's a legitimate role for government. Now, among the hyper-conservative audience that some guys record, we find that some of them were saying, wait a minute, you say the government, shouldn't the church do all that? It's ridiculous. No church, and you've heard this said, no church could possibly meet all these needs.
See, now I completely agree with you. I'm glad to hear this. And like I said, there are points that we agree. But with due respect, Bishop, I don't see that in your book. Your book, and maybe this is more Tony Perkins talking here, I don't know, your co-author, but your book seems to say that the church can do it all, and I agree with you, the church can't do it all. If they could, there wouldn't be poverty in America.
Well, yeah, and I think the book written predominantly to the religious crowd saying, hey, let's come together and solve some problems. I think our emphasis was on what the church should do, but as you recall, you at least saw, and we may not have done a good job of laser focusing this thing, but you at least saw that we say, hey, there's a role for government, there's a role for business, there's a role for the individual, and we talked about the government issues like there are various licenses that you have if you want to start a taxi.
Yeah, I agree with you on that point, actually. Your point was that taxis is a great example, in fact, of something where I completely agree with you. It's silly. You know, to get a taxi license, you should be able to drive a car.
Right.
You need a driver's license, but you know, you don't need to pay $100,000 for a medallion in New York City. I completely agree with you on that, and I actually didn't see it as a liberal conservative issue, but just sort of a good government, not so good government issue. So we do come to a lot of agreement, and I also, of course, agree with you that many people have to help themselves, and you point out in the book the benefits of a good education. You and I are both graduates of Harvard, that we recognize that a good education gets you where you need to be, no question about it. But my problem with conservatives is that I don't see a way from here to there. I mean, W.B. Du Bois talked about the talented 10th. There are always going to be some people who can escape poverty, who can escape their situation by sheer extraordinary talent.
Right.
But what about the middle 50? I mean, not the worst, not the laziest person in the world, but the the average person of average intelligence who's willing to work reasonably hard, they should be able to get ahead too, and I don't really see many policy prescriptions for that person.
Well, you're hitting something. We feel, Tony and I know I can speak this way, that if folks get a chance with business being run the right way and the church doing her job, meaning what we see the church doing is that if you attended our church, you're going through a problem, you can't make your rent, that kind of thing, we can should come around you and do that one of event. Now, we don't need to be paying your rent every month for the next 5 years.
That makes sense.
But the one of type of a situation where you need brothers and sisters to help you come together and make this thing happen, should happen. So the gap, I think, that you see is the gap between the loving, caring, functioning role of a church as a stopgap extended family. You know, many liberals quote, and Hillary Clinton quote in her book, she says, it takes a village to raise a child. And I've had all kind of debates, and many, many conservatives say, no, it doesn't take a village, it takes a mom and a dad.
I think it takes all of that.
I'm with you. It takes both and. This
right.
is not either or.
Right.
And so what happens, and the reason why I think our book is a little bit revolutionary for, from a conservative perspective, is that there has been a failure of our camp to take steps more toward the middle and say, I'm going to acknowledge that we can't do it by ourselves and that we need government, we need business, we need the church, and we need the individuals. And believe it or not, we've had some people that say, we like your book, they checked out a few things, and we tried to make sure that we had common ground for folk to step a little bit further. Because I think the real crunchy conservatives, as they're called, are living a little bit of a dream world.
I agree with you.
And they're in this place where they've got their needs met, they've made their money, or they're those tough people in the Midwest who said, by golly, I'm not taking a handout from anybody. Whereas I see that government programs are a handout if managed appropriately. And that's where you and I need to talk about how the government manages things. But managed appropriately, it should be that step up so that you can begin to take care of yourself. But I think it's demeaning for blacks or any racial group to have to live off of the government.
And to be fair, Bill Clinton, and of course he was attacked by the left for it, but many Democrats supported his workfare program. In other words, you do get help, but you have to work for it. I would go one further, though, and one of the things when I worked in Congress, we tried to make sure, is that if you're on workfare, that you get child care for your kids, because it doesn't make any sense to make a mother or a father leave their kids behind to get in all kinds of trouble and not get education and not have any care for them while they go meet this requirement to get work. And one of the things that surprised me was Republicans who supported workfare along with moderate Democrats weren't supporting the child care that was necessary to make it work. And I think you would agree with that.
I would agree with you 100%.
Let me ask you about this. This one of the big things that people on the right complain about is redistribution of wealth. They say, as you say on page 142 of your book, voting for a tax increase on your neighbor to help fund government programs to help the poor across town does not fill the mandate of this scripture. And you go, and there's no question throughout your book you're quoting a lot of scripture.
Yeah.
Well, I've read the Bible myself. I want to quote one back to you. I want to know what you think about the Jubilee year.
All right.
Because for listeners who aren't as familiar with the Bible as Bishop Jackson, you may not know that in the Old Testament there is a provision that every seventh year you leave the land fallow so that it helps the land and also helps the poor get their needs met. And then after 7 times 7 years, after 49 years, the 50th year, the Jubilee year, guess what? All the land is redistributed. Everyone gets to start over again. Socialism is part of the Bible. Now, I'm not saying that you, I mean, I don't take the Bible literally, so I don't have to be a socialist, but you do take the Bible literally. How do you feel about the Jubilee year?
I love it. I think it's a great, great thing, yeah. Because what it does is it says every 50 years, there's a cleaning of the slate,
right?
And just like some of our laws right now reflect that every 7 years, you know, your records are expunged. You
credit records.
Credit records,
right.
So those principles are kind of in our Constitution.
Bankruptcy law, for example, is part of that.
Beautiful.
Then you can start over again.
You start over again. So I think that principle is different than saying we're going to just help people who can't help themselves. Like after what I went through, to be very honest with you, back to healthcare situation, $100,000 worth of debt above and beyond anything I anticipated, all kind of special treatment. I'm still seeing a nutritionist and blah, blah, blah. And the reality is, it would be great to have some point of time where folks say, you've had this problem. We help you with this problem. Now, start over again, move forward. I can empathize today, maybe more than I could have 10 years ago, with people who just come upon a circumstance where they can't make it through. And I think that's the spirit of the Jubilee year.
Well, you mentioned, for example, that two-thirds of people in bankruptcy are because of health care situations that they couldn't control. All right, well, I'm glad we agree on this. So, but now I have to take issue then with Tony Perkins and the right. And there's no mention of the Jubilee year in your book. I looked for it. It's not something I hear from Pat Robertson. It's not something I hear from Kenneth Copeland or Tony Perkins or anybody. It sounds to me like the right doesn't want to focus on the part of the Bible, and there's a lot of it, that talks about caring for the poor, caring for the orphan, caring for the widow, and having the state do its part to care for those least among us.
Well, you hit on something really that's very, very profound. I think we do it, as we talk in the poverty chapter, but we tend to say it's our job to do it, meaning care for the poor, for your listeners, within our resources, as opposed to having government do it. And that's where folks tend to say, well, if the government does it instead of me, it's taking money from me. It's not that I'm not going to give to the poor, like Tony, for example, who, for everyone listening, he's the head of Family Research Council, a 25-year-old organization, is very involved in the conservative political world. Looking at Tony, the ex-Marine that he is, and, you know, every hair in place, he doesn't look like a compassionate guy, but he spends time going down to homeless areas, feeding people, the poor. During Katrina, his church reached out amazingly. So what we believe as conservatives is that there is, and I shouldn't say conservatives, I'm more of what I'm going to call a Christocrat than I am a Democrat or Republican. And I'm certainly not a Republican. And
I'm glad to hear that.
I'm frustrated with the Republican Party, let me go on record for saying this, because I do think that they take this high ideological ground sometimes that makes it sound like it's the Holy Grail being all conservative. And at times, they lift up their ideology more than people. That being said, there's a gap on the other side. So part of what we say in this book, and I think you've read this, is that our overcommitment to the Republican Party was a clear mistake for religious conservatives. We're saying we're social conservatives, we're biblically based, but we're not always lockstep with Republicans. In fact, you heard it here first, folks. If John McCain loses this election, and he might, it will be because he has drifted away from the social conservative group of the Republican Party. That group, if excited, could help him out a lot. He's liable to mess up because many social conservatives feel like we have been pimped, prostituted, and left standing at the altar. And all those kind of narratives.
And I definitely want to get to social conservative issues, many of them I dealt with when I was on the House Judiciary Committee. As I said in the opening, you and I were on different sides of those matters, but that's okay.
Yeah.
First of all, I do want to get our listeners in. Folks, if you want to join in this discussion, it's easy to do. Just dial in 202-588-0893, or if you're listening on the Internet, you can call toll-free 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. Jeff, welcome.
Hi.
Hello, welcome.
Welcome. And I was in the dark. I heard nothing.
You're here. What's your comment or question?
Well, it's about gay marriage.
Okay.
And gay rights.
Okay.
Okay, I am a Christian. I'm a long-time Christian.
Right.
But I feel that the Christian right is wrong on gay marriage.
Tell me why.
Okay. Gay marriage, well, marriage is not the purview of the church. I mean, people get married in church for the ceremony. But one thing that, and I'm a photographer, by the way, at least on one side of the week. And every wedding I've ever shot, the minister said, hey, come over here and sign these papers. Because if you don't, you're not married.
Right.
Because it's the state that marries you, not the church.
Right. Civil marriage versus religious marriage. I think it's a great point, Jeff. Let me pose it to my guest. Bishop, look. Everyone knows or should know that there's two different kinds of marriage. There's civil marriage given by the state, and there's religious marriage given by the church.
Right.
If I can agree with you that the state should never, ever define church marriages, that the Catholic Church can say, we're not going to marry non-Catholics, or if you don't raise the child Catholic, or if you don't get a divorce in a Catholic way, or you can have a church that requires anything. That's fine. Fine with me. That's the church's policy. Hands off, church off state. If I can get the state off of your church, can you get the church away from my state and say, if you've got a gay couple who love each other, they're not a member of your church, you don't own them, they're fellow American citizens, why can't they have the same equal rights to marriage that any straight couple can have under civil law? They can't get married in your church, but they should be getting married by the state of California.
Well, I'm going to say this to Jeff. Jeff, I appreciate your calling and your straight question, clear Skype question. We had a group called Soul Force at a church Sunday before last. An interesting exchange with them on a Saturday night. My position is a little bit different than some. I believe that marriage should be defined as a man and a woman. But if there is a civil rights gap of 1,100 regulations.
Let's not say if. Let's say there is a civil rights gap. So you can agree with me. There's no question that there is a civil rights gap.
I agree. I don't know if there's 1,100, but I know that there seems to be. Seems to be a civil rights gap to me. I agree. But haven't the parties, once again, polarized the people? Haven't the Republicans said, well, we're not going to touch any civil rights issues in here at all. We're going to make this thing be about marriage or not. And the Democrats the same way. So my thought is, marriage is an institution sanctioned by God. I believe it's a spiritual institution. Some form of civil unions and other kinds of unions, that's the government's job. So why in the world don't these politicians, and you work there, and I think I have an answer for why they don't talk reasonably, why don't they sit down and say, okay, these are legitimate issues. One of the couples that came to talk with us the other night was a gay woman named Michelle. She and her
partner,
thank you. I was about to call her wife.
You can call her wife if they've had a marriage ceremony and consider themselves married.
So they consider themselves married. But they were saying, they said that they had to spend about $5,000 in legal fees in order to come up with these things that give them
some of the same rights, but even they can't get them all by legal method. So are you saying, Bishop, that you support full civil union benefits of equal rights, absolute equality under the law, as it says in the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, equal protection under the laws? You would support giving gay couples equality under the law with straight couples who are married. You just don't want to call it by the name marriage?
I
don't think your co-author, Tony Perkins, would agree with
you. No, I don't want to call it marriage. But
I know you don't want to call it marriage, but you're willing to support equal rights.
Yes, because I believe that there is a thin line between the equal individual rights that everyone should have under our democracy and distorting an institution that has been here so long. So I'm talking about, let's start looking at what are the specifics we need to put on this table. Now, the problem we have in this all or nothing at all combat zone that we're in over marriage, and I'm going to be against gay marriage in California, and we're for the traditional marriage amendment in California that, just came out, that they got enough signatures, that's going to be in the ballot. And I'll be sending teams out there. We'll be fighting for it.
And I'll be fighting against it, I assure you.
I know you will. But the reality is, I believe that there is this line of demarcation and that we haven't done the following thing. We haven't said, show us the rights that need to be changed and that have been abridged, and let's have a political solution around whatever civil unions look like, do that, and protect marriage. I think essentially in Maryland, that's how the state has begun to push us.
And even they haven't even come close. I mean, there's only about 6 or 7 states in the United States, maybe 10 if you push it. None of them give full equal rights to gay people. In fact, the Defense of Marriage Act specifically says that gay people should live separate and unequal. It's not even as good as Plessy v. Ferguson. It's not even separate and equal. It's separate and unequal. And I got to say, your co-author, Tony Perkins, I don't think supports equality for gay couples.
No.
I mean, the right, I don't see many people on the right, and I'm talking about the religious right. I'm not talking about Arnold Schwarzenegger and some of the more moderate Republicans.
Right.
But the religious right is saying, in effect, they want gay couples to be separate and unequal. They're not even supporting civil unions. Have you talked with them to get them to support civil unions?
No. I've talked to them, and we have a wide disagreement. And I'm saying that in the civil union debate, let me be more clear, that there's room for movement, that specific rights need to be addressed. And I'm not saying that I need – here's my problem.
see, don't support equal rights under the law.
No. But I'm saying if two people choose to live with each other, there should be some protection, some equality. That line
some equality. Yeah. See, now, even those words, some equality, some parity, to me, that's an oxymoron. That's a contradiction. Either people are equal, 14th Amendment says we all have equal protection on the laws. Either gay couples are equal to straight couples and should have the same rights, and a gay American should have the same rights as a straight American, or they're second-class citizens. And I think the religious right wants gay people to be second-class citizens. So when you say some equality, immediately that makes my antenna rise and say, you don't believe in full equality.
Well, see, I see it a different way. I don't see it as a civil rights issue. I see it as marriage being a sacred institution, and that if you choose to live with someone, I would say, hey, if they're sick, if there's transfer of property you want to do, if there's certain other relational things that you want to take care of that are not the automatic kind of...
Why should it be automatic? Look, let me ask you this. If marriage is a sacred institution and a holy religious institution, then maybe the government should just stay out of it entirely. Separation of church and state. Everyone can get, quote, civil married, unquote, and then to get a religious marriage, you have to go to your church. If you want, you can call civil marriages civil unions, but at least we're treating everyone equally under the law. Isn't that the right way to go?
I get your point. I would say no, but I'm going to say it this way. I think there are some steps up toward equality that need to be taken. For example, when I first heard the question, back in 2004, you know, the huge hubbub about marriage in Massachusetts and how intense it had gotten, I thought to myself and did a little research, if someone could not visit their partner in the hospital, I mean, that seems to be absolutely stupid. If you can't transfer your property, again, it's your property. Why can't you give it to whoever you wanted to? I mean, to me, that was a glaring type of situation. If in other areas, gays are treated differently than...
How about Social Security benefits, veterans benefits? These are federal benefits that you give to spouses. Shouldn't gay people have the same rights as straight people do?
My thought would be, if we're going to go that way as a culture,
I hope you convince Tony Perkins to support it.
I'm not going to try to convince him today, but he probably won't agree with it.
I don't think he will either.
But I do believe that this dialogue and discussion has to be had on an intelligent basis and say, let's parse out these 1,100 laws that everybody keeps throwing around, and let's say this applies, this doesn't, this works, this doesn't, as opposed to if you buy my concern that marriage has been devalued, in a black community especially, we just have this horrible thing that's going on, and our family breakdowns are not just the result of gay people.
I don't think it has anything to do with gay people. Let me be on the record and say, yes, there's a problem with marriage. You can talk about no-fault divorce. You can talk about the black family.
That's right.
That's all fair and good, and I'm happy to talk about that. But stop blaming gay people for things that have nothing to do with gay people.
No, I'm a gay. Blame them. I'm going to say that in other cultures that gay marriage has been put in place, it becomes that additional burden where the whole institution is devalued.
Now, wait a minute. There's no connection between the fact that gay couples can get married and the fact that there's disintegration of family. You can have disintegration. I mean, there's no, I can't say there any way. I mean, you got a husband and wife, okay,
right.
And they're married.
Yep.
And they're either having trouble or they're not having trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Explain to me, because I don't get it, how the fact that two gay people they don't even know down the street, or they do know down the street, are allowed to get married, how does that affect whether or not a marriage between a husband and wife is working or not?
Let me go back to basic sociology. We're talking about social norms, okay? And all we're dealing with is a Harvard-trained professor, Dr. Stanley Kurtz, if folks can Google him up, did a series of studies in places where gay marriage had become the law of the land of the nation, and he tracked an out-of-wedlock birth rate that soared in certain nations, and he tracked that parallel thing. So what I'm saying is we're in free fall in the culture. That's our concern. And what we don't want to do is create an environment where what is already a bad situation is worsened by the devaluation of the institution. That's the argument, Dr. Kurtz.
You know, you can always find things that run in parallel. I mean, I forget. I think when there are more sunspots, the Yankees win. When there are less, the Red Sox win.
Oh, no.
I don't think there's any connection between them. I mean, certainly in the Moynihan Report, we learned about all kinds of trouble with the black family from the 1960s to 2004 that had absolutely nothing to do with gay people. So I think that's a little overrated. But I want to get to some other callers if I can, because they may have other issues. Austin, welcome to Dialogue.
Hey, man, how are you doing today?
Doing good. What's your question or comment?
Question real quick is, I'm going to take that game and explain this a little bit further.
Okay.
I have, it's more of a political question. It's me growing up in the back in Jerusalem as a Palestinian. And when I came here, I talked to hardcore evangelical people and say, you know what, you know, God promised the land to those people and you guys are nothing. Basically, you guys are nothing. I feel exactly, you know, social injustice and a lot of injustice, you know, those people are saying about, you know, oh, I just don't exist, you know, just because that's what God said. He promised them that land and you guys are basically screwed and you're out of luck. And I've talked to a lot of, you know, evangelicals, a lot of Baptists, and you always say, well, no matter what you do, God promised the land to them. You guys have nothing to do with it. You guys don't even, you know, it doesn't matter what happens.
Sounds like you're talking more about Israel than gay marriage, which is fine. I can certainly ask the bishop
about it. He's making a parallel. He's saying, can I ask you, are you gay?
You don't have to answer that.
No, I'm just wondering the identification. He sounded like I'm saying how I felt, you know, trying to paraphrase this, as in this whole Israeli-Palestinian debate where the Palestinians were considered nobody, I feel that gay people are being treated the same way. That's what I thought he was saying. You know, developing this parallel kind of structure. And that folks who feel like gay shouldn't be married are saying that they're nothing. I think that that's an illogical progression based on individual rights. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying it's a sacred institution. And that's the place where I'm having a problem finding out where individual rights end and where the privileges for the sacred institution begin.
Well, why don't we just follow good old Thomas Jefferson, who talked about, you quote him in your book, a wall of separation between church and state. It seems to me that you can live completely free and allow the church to do whatever it wants, and it can teach whatever it wants, and it can marry whoever it wants, and the state won't try to control that, and then vice versa, the church shouldn't be controlling what the state does. I mean, can we agree, and it's broader than the question of marriage, that if you have your religious beliefs, and I don't share them, you have every right to talk about your religious beliefs and your church. You have every right to try to convince me to join your religion. But at the end of the day, you don't have the right to use the power of the state to force someone who doesn't agree with your religion to follow your religious principles.
Well, that's a great point. We should never use the power of the state to force someone else to do what only our religion believes. I think that that would bring us into a theocracy.
I agree. And yet, for example, you complain about prayer in schools, which is banned, of course, prayer in public schools.
Right.
Now, the problem with prayer in public schools is I don't think you can devise for me a prayer. In fact, I know you can't. That would satisfy 300 million Americans. I think you can agree with me. There's no prayer. Whatever you say, no matter how calm or whatever, they're atheists, you're not going to find one. And yet, but when you want prayer in public schools, aren't you, in essence, saying you want your prayer in public schools? You don't want Allah or Buddha or something you don't believe in the public schools.
No,
that's a theocracy, isn't it?
No, I think you're saying that the freedom to pray in the schools, since we're majority Christian, it'll be a majority Christian. But I do think that religious liberty has got to mean freedom for everyone to express their religion as long as it doesn't, you know, violate major laws. And so
let me be clear. I fully support the right of students to bond together in voluntary biblical studies after school, pray together. They can, just like the chess club, the biblical club, the Gay Straight Alliance, or the Democratic club, people can join, or the gun club, whatever it is. They can join in it. They can pray together. That's fine. I'm a good liberal. I have no problem with that. Our problem with prayer in public schools is when you have to sit there, whether you believe in that religion or not, and have the teacher read a government-sanctioned prayer. I got a real problem with that, and I think the Constitution's on my side. What do you think?
I have a problem with forcing someone who doesn't want to pray in the way that's comfortable to me. So I think what we'd have to devise is an opportunity for prayer to happen. And some of the stuff, you can't go back and recover it. I mean, what should have happened is they should have stopped and preserved those rights at the time. Sometimes the culture moves on. We're in a whole different place. But I think the idea that I can't pray in the name of Jesus if I were to pray that way and without offending someone or whatever can be a problem I go to graduation.
Well, no, but you can pray that way. You just can't have a teacher lead their third grade class that way. I mean, you can't have a position of authority. It's one thing to have individual children say whatever they want, at least as far as I'm concerned, but it's quite another when you have an authority figure say, we're all going to pray to Jesus now in a public school.
Well, I like your distinction, because a lot of folks are saying, take it out altogether. I mean, I've been hearing, again, it's similar to issues of what should you put up in terms of signs and in public places and all of this kind of stuff. The Ten Commandments now is not so much religious. We talked about this earlier. It's a foundation of many of our right and wrong credos in our culture. And the Ten Commandments no longer means Christian. It could mean Jewish. It could mean Christian. It's really more of
It's a cultural thing, but I hope you'd be willing to put up things like the Code of Hammurabi, too. I mean, my own point, I have no problem with posting the Ten Commandments as long as you're willing to post other religious codes, because I don't want to have one favorite religion. Even though Christianity is the majority religion in this country, I think it's clear that a lot of people came to America to escape religious persecution, and there shouldn't be a favorite religion. We got a lot of callers. I want to give them a chance to speak. RG, welcome. RG, and actually, when I worked in the Judiciary Committee, I actively opposed those faith-based initiatives. What's your view, Bishop?
Well, I think it's a wonderful idea, and the idea is find somebody who's already doing good things, and it's based on their value system, and et cetera, and fund them to do the good things that they're doing. If you believe their good works are measurable and they're in accordance with your overall cultural goals. Now, having said that, there's been so much problem actually getting the money to people. I sat across from someone, won't mention his name, major national religious figure, famous preacher, who said he had spent more money trying to comply with the faith-based initiative rules than the final amount of money he got awarded. And it seems like it was a Don Quixote-like dream that has really failed in terms of the number of dollars that come out. David Quayle's book, you remember his book?
I do. Talk about the Mayberry Machiavellis in the administration.
Yeah, so, I mean, the reality is, I think it was a good idea. Folks may disagree. But the reality was, even that good idea could not get administrated.
Bishop, let me tell you why I oppose the faith-based initiative. And I'll make it brief because I know we have a lot of callers that are hanging on. The problem with the faith-based initiative was not that the government was giving money to religious organizations. In fact, the government has given money to Catholic Charities, United Methodist, Jewish Federation for 20, 30 years. That was never mentioned in the debate on faith-based initiative. The problem was George Bush wanted a specific kind of faith group to get money, the kind that discriminated. George Bush wanted money to go to organizations that would only hire people of their own faith. So if it's the Nation of Islam, they would only hire black Muslims. If it was a Baptist organization, they would only hire Baptists. Jews only hiring Jews. And our feeling was, if you got a federal job, you should never discriminate on the basis of religion on a federal job. We had no problem helping faith-based organizations. Our problem was they wanted to discriminate, and that's why we opposed
it. Mark, you're a little bit wrong on this one. How can I bring in to, let's say, a Christian daycare center, and I'm going to be teaching all these people about Christ, you're going to bring some Buddhist in there who's going to say, well, Jesus, we're not sure, he's one of the many gods.
Because the money wasn't supposed to go to talking about Jesus. The money was supposed to go into drug treatment, into feeding the hungry. And a Buddhist can teach, don't do drugs and can feed the hungry. When you start getting to talking about Jesus, then no, I don't want federal dollars to go into that. I don't think that federal dollars should support teaching about Jesus. They should support feeding the hungry and clothing the poor. So that's where we disagree. I want to get some more callers tonight. A whole bunch of them. Greg, welcome.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing good.
All right.
Wonderful.
Yeah, quickly, I got two questions I guess.
Real quick.
to understand that, but I would consider that, if I were to prioritize what's most important, what's going on right now, that would fall way down the list. You see what I'm saying? I would much rather deal with bread and butter issues. Now, to the minister, the disconnect that I see, and I'm a Christian, the disconnect I see from the religious right is that when it comes to U.S. foreign policy, I never hear the religious right speak against the atrocities of warfare. And on one hand, we say we're pro-life. We believe in the sacredness and the sanctity of life. But then we never speak out against a war under false pretenses. Matter of fact, we cheer war. And we're almost ravenous in support for the administration.
That is a great question. And Bishop somewhat addresses it in his book. Go ahead, Bishop.
Yeah, but I would agree with your guess. We do talk about our caller. Again, the title of this book, I'm going to repeat, is Personal Faith, Public Policy. I wish some of the people listening would get the book, read it. But it's a starting point. We talk about the fact that there can be a just war. What we don't really spend enough time talking about is that all war, in my view, is a manifestation of sin. And that we've somehow fallen short, and now we've got to pick up arms to solve a problem. And I agree with you. My hope in writing the book with Tony Perkins, I'm a black man, he's a white man, I'm a registered Democrat, he's a Republican, is that we can start to come together and we can marshal the forces numerically of the religious right to bring this balance you talk about. We do talk about life on the continuum in the book, and I think that that isn't talked about enough. You're absolutely right. And there is a certain amount of hypocrisy between what we call righteousness and justice. The idea the evangelicals have fallen short of really emphasizing biblically-based social justice, and that's sinful. And that's why we apologize for having been in the pocket of the Republican Party, who wanted to try this out when it's convenient for them and get people all hyped up and afraid at the election time.
I agree with you. I agree with the caller, too. I should say, though, that in your book, you're agnostic on Iraq. You don't take a position on it. And I was kind of wishing you would. Just to answer quickly on the gay issues, that those were raised by two callers. That was their concerns. And I always like to address my listeners' concerns. Let's go to Jim. Jim, welcome.
Thank you. I have a question on the gay issue.
Okay.
Oh, mercy.
Well, that's his concern. Go ahead.
Okay.
I can barely hear you. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can hear you.
I'm black. I grew up in the South, the segregated South, in the born in 39. And I'm also Baptist. I'm not gay. I just don't understand the right when it comes to the gay issue. For example, we will accept, when I say we, I mean generally it is accepted that a person can be born with all kinds of physical or mental deformities. But when it comes to sexuality, it has to be either heterosexual or gay. And I don't understand why it's not within God's plan. If these other deformities are accepted, that a person could be born, if you will, with a deformed sexuality.
Tim, let me take your question. I would pose it in a more neutral way. I wouldn't use the word deformative. But I would pose it in a more neutral way. Some people are born right-handed. Some people are born left-handed. The majority right, but a significant minority left-handed. Why can't it be the case the majority are born heterosexual and the minority are born homosexual? And let's live and let live. They don't have to join your church, but leave gay people alone.
Well, again, his question about deformity would be easier to answer when she would say, certain deformities that children have, you try to correct them through corrective surgery, some kind of medical treatment. There are many people who feel very, very offended if you say that, hey, we have ministries in our church that will try to help you find out your get in sync with your true sexual identity.
Well, I'm offended by that because I don't think you're trying to help the person express themselves. You're trying to fit them into a certain mold.
Well, I disagree.
Okay, let me get to my last caller, though, because we only have a little bit of time left. Angela, you are our last caller. Make your point or ask your question.
It's on the gay marriage topic. Earlier the bishop was saying that he thought that gay couples should have some rights. I just wondered if he could come up with an example of the type of right that a gay couple, like, wouldn't deserve.
Yeah, well, where do you think gay people should not be equal? with straight people?
That's really an unfair question. I'm saying to you that I've been told 1,100 laws. I have not looked at them. In a spirit of openness and not trying to be phony with you, and I feel so often that the hatred coming from gays who feel like everybody's against them sometimes doesn't do you a service, or I shouldn't say you, as you may not be gay, but do the community a service. So I'm saying the spirit of personal social equity, let's sit down. Why don't these politicians stop batting about verbiage from left to right and going for votes only and say, what are the true rights that are being abridged? And is there a way that we can deal with a civil union approach versus marriage approach? And what does that look like in terms of specifics? So I can't answer the questions.
We have to wrap up. Angela, I used to work on House Judiciary Committee. I am familiar with those 1,100 rights. It's actually about 1,100 state rights and another 1,000-plus federal rights. Wow. I've actually seen them, and I don't see that there's any possibility that we can get any American not have equal rights under the law. You've said, gay people express hate. To me, it's not so much hate but frustration of being treated with unequally. I don't think blacks that were mistreated in the civil rights era, what they hated was the mistreatment. They didn't hate whites. They hated Jim Crow. They hated separate but equal. And I think that whenever you have people treated as second-class citizens, they're upset. And it's not hatred. It's simply wishing to be equal citizens under the law. This is a debate that will continue. Angela, I promise you I'm going to get to Bishop Jackson, that list of thousands of rights. And he and I are going to continue this dialogue in many places on that issue and a number of other issues. The book, which deals with many different issues that we didn't get a chance to discuss, but we will on a future day, perhaps, is Personal Faith, Public Policy. The author is Harry Jackson and Tony Perkins. Bishop Jackson, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you, Mark. You're a gracious host.
Thank you.